Chapter 12. At the moment when Monty Bodkin and the Honourable Galahad Threepwood, two minds with but a single thought, were wondering where he was and wishing they could have a word with him, Percy Pilbeam, the manuscript under his arm, had just emerged furtively from the back of the castle. He did not wish to have anything to do with front doors. Directly he had crawled out from under Monty's bed, dragging his treasure trove after him, he had dusted his fingers and made for the servants' staircase. This had led him through twisting byways to a vast, echoing stone passage, and from that to the back door was but a step. He had not encountered so much as a housemaid. In his bearing, as he hurried along the path that skirted the kitchen garden, in the oily smirk beneath his repellent moustache, in the jaunty tilt of his snub nose, even in the terraced sweep of the brilliantine swamps of his corrugated hair, there was the look of a man who is congratulating himself on a neat bit of work. Brains, reflected Percy Pilbeam. That was what you needed in this life. Brains, and the ability to seize your opportunity when it was offered to you. He had a long walk before him. It was his intention, in order to avoid meeting any interested party, to make a wide circle round the outskirts of Lord Emsworth's domain and strike the road to Market Blandings near Matchingham. There, no doubt, he would be able to get a lift to the Emsworth Arms. Then, having seen Lord Tilbury and arrived at some satisfactory financial arrangement with him, he proposed to take the next train to London. He had his whole plan of campaign neatly mapped out. The one thing he had not allowed for was a sudden change in the weather. When he had left the castle, the sun was shining, but now it was blotted out by a dark rack of clouds. Apparently some minor storm, late for the big event, had come hurrying up and intended to hold a private demonstration of its own. There was a tentative rumble over the hills, and a raindrop splashed on his face. Before he had reached the end of the kitchen garden, quite a respectable deluge was falling. Pilbeam, like the Honourable Galahad, hated getting wet. He looked about him for shelter, and perceived standing by itself in a small paddock not far away a squat building of red brick and timber. A man not used to country life, he had no idea what it was supposed to be, but it had a stout tiled roof beneath which he could keep dry, so he hastened thither, arriving just in time, for a moment later the world had become a shower bath. He retreated further into his nook and sat down on some straw. In such a situation, the only method of passing the time is to think. Pilbeam thought, and as he did so, he began to revise the scheme of his of taking the manuscript straight to Lord Tilbury. It was a scheme which he had adopted as seeming to be the only one open to him. He would vastly have preferred his original idea of holding an auction sale with Lord Tilbury and Lady Constance Keble raising each other's bids. But until now, the fatal objection to that course had seemed to him to be that there was no safe place where he could store the goods till the auction sale was over. A visitor at a country house with something to hide is a good deal restricted in his choice of caches. He is, indeed, more or less driven back to his bedroom. And a bedroom, as has been proved in the case of Monty Bodkin, is very far from being a safe deposit. From the inception of their acquaintance, Pilbeam had been greatly impressed by Lady Constance's strong personality. A woman of action, he considered, if ever there was one. If she knew that he had the manuscript and deduced that it was hidden in his bedroom, he could see her acting very swiftly. She would have the thing in her hands in half an hour. But suppose he were to hide it in some such place as that in which he was now sitting? Things would be very different then. He glanced round the dim interior and felt that he was on the right track. This building was a deserted building. It did not appear to be used for anything. Presumably, no one ever came here. And even if someone did happen to wander in, it would be a simple matter to hide the manuscript under this straw, for instance. He rose and thrust the papers under the straw. He eyed the straw appraisingly. It had as innocent look as any straw he had ever seen. A shaft of sunlight played in the doorway. The brief storm was over. Well content, Percy Pilbeam came out and started to walk back to the castle. Beach met him in the hall. "Her ladyship is expressing a desire to see you, sir," said Beach, regarding him with restrained horror and loathing. The recent exchange of remarks between Monty Bodkin and the Honourable Galahad in his presence had confirmed the butler in his view that of all the human serpents that ever wriggled their way into a respectable castle, this private investigator was the worst. Knowing what the manuscript of the reminiscences meant to Mr. Ronald and his betrothed, Beach, had he been younger and slimmer and in better condition and not a butler, could, for two pins, have taken Percy Pilgrim's unpleasant neck in his hands and twisted it into a lover's knot. His physique and his circumstances being as they were, he merely delivered the message he had been instructed to deliver. As far as any hostile demonstration was concerned, he had to be content with letting his lip curl. Percy Pilbeam, however, was feeling far too pleased with himself to be daunted by butler's curling lips. On the present occasion, moreover, he was not aware that the other's lip was curling. He had noted the facial spasm, but attributed it to a tickling nose.
Lady Constance?
Yes, sir. Her ladyship is in the drawing-room, awaiting you. What the proprietor of Riggs' Golden Balm Imbrication would have described as the delightful sensation of bien-être began to leave Pilbeam. He stood there looking thoughtful. He twisted his moustache uneasily. Now that the moment had actually arrived for confronting Lady Constance Keeble and informing her that he was proposing to double-cross her and hold her up and extract large sums of money from her, he felt unpleasantly weak about the knees. Said Percy Pilbeam. And then, suddenly, he remembered that nature in her infinite wisdom had provided a sovereign specific against these Lady Constance Keebles.
"Well, then, I'll tell you what," he said, inspired. "Bring me a large bottle of champagne, and I'll look into the matter."
Beach withdrew to execute the commission. His demeanour, as he passed from the hall, was downcast. There, in a nutshell, he was feeling, you had the tragedy of a butler's life. His not to reason why. His not to discriminate between the deserving and the undeserving. His but to go and bring bottles of champagne to marcelled-haired snakes, to whom he would greatly have preferred to supply straight cyanide. The eternal conflict between duty and personal inclination, with duty because one was a conscientious worker and took one's profession reverently, winning hands down. Her sister Julia's report of her conversation with the Honourable Galahad, retailed to her immediately upon the latter's departure, had strengthened Lady Constance Keeble's already firm view that something had got to be done without any more of what she forcefully described as dilly-dallying. The fact that it was now 3 days since the task of securing the manuscript had been placed in Percy Pilbeam's hands, and that he had to all appearances accomplished absolutely nothing, seemed to her to argue dilly-dallying of the worst kind, if not actual shilly-shallying. She could not understand why Sir Gregory Parslow seemed to entertain so high an opinion of this young man's abilities. So far as she'd been able to ascertain, they were non-existent, and she said as much to Lady Julia, who agreed with her. It was, therefore, to no warm-hearted assembly of personal admirers that Pilbeam, some quarter of an hour later, proceeded to betake himself. If his specific had acted a little less rapidly, he might have been frozen to the bone by the cold wave of aristocratic disapproval which poured over him as he entered the drawing-room. As it was, the sight of Lady Constance staring haughtily from a high-backed chair like Cleopatra about to get down to brass tacks with an Ethiopian slave merely entertained him. He thought she looked quaint. He was feeling just the slightest bit dizzy, but extraordinarily debonair. If Lady Constance at that moment had proposed a little part-singing, he would have fallen in with the suggestion eagerly.
"You want to see me, Beach says,"
he observed, slurring the honoured name a little.
"Sit down, Mr. Pilbeam."
The detective was glad to do so. Spiritually, he was at the peak of his form, but as regards his legs, there appeared to be some slight engine trouble.
"Now then, Mr. Pilbeam, about that book."
"Quite," said Pilbeam, smiling benignly. This, he was feeling, was just the sort of thing he enjoyed, a cosy chat on current literature with cultured women. He was about to say so when his eye, wandering to the wall, caught that of the fourth countess, Amelia Jane, 1747 to 1815, and so humorous did her aspect seem to him that he lay back in his chair, laughing immoderately.
"Mr. Pilbeam!"
Before the detective had time to explain that his mirth had been caused by the fact that the fourth countess looked exactly like Buster Keaton, Lady Constance had gone on speaking. She spoke well and vigorously.
"I cannot understand, Mr. Pilbeam, what you have been doing all this time. You know perfectly well the vital importance of getting my brother's book into our hands. The whole thing has been clearly explained to you both by Sir Gregory Parslow and myself, and yet you appear to have done nothing whatever about it. Sir Gregory told me you were enterprising. You seem to me to have about as much enterprise as a...
She paused to search her mind for fauna of an admittedly unenterprising outlook on life, and Lady Julia, who'd been listening with approval, supplied the word slug. The agitation which Lady Julia Fish had betrayed in the presence of her brother Galahad had passed. She had become her cool, sardonic self again. She was watching Pilbeam with a brightly interested eye, trying to diagnose the strangeness which she sensed in his manner.
"Exactly," said Lady Constance, welcoming the suggestion. "As much enterprise as a slug."
"Less," said Lady Julia.
"Yes, less," agreed Lady Constance.
"Much less," said Lady Julia.
"I've seen some quite nippy slugs."
Pilbeam's amiability waned a little. He frowned. His mind was not at its clearest, but it seemed to him that a derogatory remark had been passed. The Pilbeams had always been a clan to stand up for themselves. Treat them right, and if it suited their convenience, they would treat you right. But try to come it over them, and they could be very terrible. It was a Pilbeam, Ernest William of Monabree, Kitchener Road, East Dulwich, who sued his next-door neighbour, George Dobson of the Elms, for throwing snails over the fence into his back garden. Another Pilbeam, Claude, once refused to give up his hat and umbrella at the Hornybrook Natural History Museum, Sydenham Hill. P. Frobisher was no unworthy kin of these sturdy fighters.
"Did you call me a slug?" he said sternly.
"In a purely Pickwickian sense," said Lady Julia.
"Ah," said Pilbeam, his affability returning. "That's different."
Lady Constance resumed the speech for the prosecution.
"You've had 3 whole days in which to do something, and you have not even found out where the manuscript is."
Pilbeam smiled roguishly.
"Oh, haven't I?" "Well, have you?"
"Yes, I have."
"Then why in the name of goodness, Mr. Pilbeam," said Lady Constance, "did you not tell us? And why don't you do something about it? Where is it, then? You said it was not in my brother's desk. Did he give it to somebody else?"
"He gave it to Bysshe."
"Bysshe?" Lady Constance seemed at a loss. "Bysshe?"
"Reading between the lines," said Lady Julia, "I think he means Beech." Lady Constance uttered an exclamation that was almost a battle cry. This was better than she'd hoped. She felt a complete confidence in her ability to impose her will upon the domestic staff.
"Beech?" Her eyes lit up. "I will see Beech at once."
Pilbeam chuckled heartily.
"You may see him," he said, "but a fat lot of good that's going to do you. A fat, fat, fat lot of good."
Lady Julia had completed her diagnosis.
"Forgive the personal question, Mr. Pilbeam," she said, "but are you slightly intoxicated?"
"Yes," said Pilbeam sunnily.
"I thought so."
Lady Constance was less intrigued by the detective's physical condition than the mystical obscurity of his speech.
"What do you mean?"
"A little blotto," exclaimed Pilbeam. "I've just had a bottle of champagne, and what's more, I had it on an empty stomach."
"Are you interested in Mr. Pilbeam's stomach, Constance?"
"I am not."
"Nor I," said Lady Julia. "Let us waive your stomach, Mr. Pilbeam, and get back to the point. Why will it do us a fat lot of good seeing Beech?"
"Because he hasn't got it."
"You seem to suggest that he had."
"So he had, but he hasn't. He gave it to Ronnie."
"My son, do you mean?"
"That's right. I always think of him as Ronnie."
"How sweet of you."
"He tried to break my neck once,"
said Pilbeam, throwing out the information for what it was worth.
"And, of course, that forms a bond,
doesn't it?" said Lady Julia sympathetically.
"So now Ronnie has the manuscript."
"No, he hasn't."
"But you said he had."
"I said he had, and he had. But he hasn't. He gave it to Bonte Modkin."
"Oh, this man's impossible," cried Lady Constance.
Pilbeam looked about him, but could see no man. Some mistake, probably.
"What is the good of wasting any more time on a person in his condition? Can't you see he's just maundering?"
"Wait a minute, Connie. I may be wrong, but I think something will soon emerge from the fumes. Everybody seems to have been handing Galahad's great work to somebody else. A little patient inquiry, and he may discover to whom Mr. Bodkin handed it."
Pilbeam laughed a ringing laugh.
"Handed it? He's good. Oh, very good indeed, considering that I had to crawl under his bed to get it."
"What?"
"Gave my head a nasty bump, too, on the woodwork. Do you mean to say, Mr. Pilbeam, that all this time we've been talking, you have got my brother's manuscript?
I told you something would emerge, Connie.
Yes, Connie, said Pilbeam, I have. Then why, in the name of goodness, could you not have said so from the first? Where is it?
Ah, that's telling, said Pilbeam, wagging a playful finger.
Mr. Pilbeam, said Lady Constance, with all the Cleopatrine haughtiness at her command, I insist on knowing what you have done with it. Kindly let us have no more of this nonsense.
She could not have taken a more unfortunate attitude. The detective's resemblance to a roguish, if slightly inebriated, pixie vanished, and in its place came pique, mortification, resentment, anger, and defiance. His beady little eyes hardened, and from them there peeped out the fighting spirit of that Albert Edward Pilbeam, who once refused to pay a fine, and did 7 days in Brixton jail for failing to abate a smoky chimney.
Oh, he said. Oh, it's like that, is it? Let me tell you, Connie, that I don't like your tone. Insist, indeed, a nice way to talk. I've got that manuscript hidden away somewhere where you won't find it, let me inform you, and it's going to stay there till I take it to Tilbury.
What is he talking about? Asked Lady Constance despairingly.
Tilbury, to her, suggested merely a small town in Essex. She had a vague recollection that Queen Elizabeth had once held a review there or something. But Lady Julia, with her special knowledge of Tilbury's, had become suddenly grave. Wait, she said. This is beginning to look a little sticky.
I wouldn't take it to Lord Tilbury, Mr. Pilbeam. Really, I wouldn't. I'm sure if we can only talk it over sensibly, we can come to some arrangement.
Pilbeam, who had risen and was now tacking uncertainly towards the door, waved a hand and clutched at a table to restore his balance.
Too late, he said. Too late for that. Been insulted. Don't like Connie's tone. I was going to sit down and let you bid against each other, but too late, too late, too late, because I've been insulted. No further discussion. Tilbury gets it. He's waiting for it at the Emsworth Arms. Well, goodbye, said Percy Pilbeam, and was gone.
Lady Constance turned to her sister for enlightenment.
But I don't understand, Julia. What did he mean? Who is this Lord Tilbury?
Only the proprietor of the publishing concern with whom Galley signed his contract, my angel. Nothing more than that.
You mean, cried Lady Constance aghast, that if the manuscript gets into his hands, he will publish it?
That's it.
I won't allow him to. I'll get an injunction.
How can you? He'll stand on the contract.
Do you mean, then, there's nothing can be done?
All I can suggest is that you telephone to Sir Gregory Parslow and get him over. Tell him to come to dinner. He seems to have some influence with that little fiend. He may be able to talk him round, though I doubt it. He's in a nasty mood. I rather wish sometimes, Connie, said Lady Julia meditatively, that you were a little less of the grande dame. It's wonderful to watch you in action, I admit. One seems to hear the bugles blowing for the Crusades and the tramp of the mailed feet of the 100 steel-clad ancestors. But there's no getting away from it, that you do put people's backs up a bit. Down at the Emsworth Arms, a servitor informed Lord Tilbury that he was wanted on the telephone. He walked to the instrument broodingly. The Bodkin Popinjay, he presumed, that broken reed on which he had foolishly supposed that it would be possible to lean. He prepared to be a little terse with Monty. Ever since his interview with Monty in the garden of the Emsworth Arms, Lord Tilbury had found his thoughts turning wistfully to the one man of his acquaintance who could have been relied upon to put through this commission of his. During the years when P. Frobisher Pilbeam had worked on his staff as editor of Society Spice, Lord Tilbury had never actually asked him to steal anything, but he had no doubt at all that, if adequately paid, Percy would have sprung to the task. And now that he was blossoming out as a private investigator, it was probable that he would spring to it with an even greater readiness. All that afternoon, Lord Tilbury had been wondering whether the solution of the whole thing would not be to send Pilbeam a wire, telling him to come at once. What deterred him was the reflection that it would be impossible to get him into the castle. You cannot insert private inquiry agents in country houses as if you were slipping ferrets down a rabbit hole. This it was that had made him abandon the roseate dream, and it was the fact that he had been compelled to abandon it that lent additional asperity to his manner as he now took up the receiver.
Yes, he said curtly. Well?
A rollicking voice nearly cracked his eardrum.
Hello there, Tilbury. This is Pilbeam.
Lord Tilbury's eyes seemed to shoot out suddenly, like a snail's. This was the most amazing coincidence he'd ever experienced. More a miracle, he felt with some awe, than a mere coincidence.
Speaking from Blandings Castle, Tilbury!
What? The receiver shook in Lord Tilbury's hands. Was this what was known as the direct answer to prayer? Or, taking the gloomier view, was he undergoing some aural hallucination?
Speaking from Blandings Castle, Tilbury, repeated the voice. You don't mind me calling you Tilbury, do you, Tilbury?
It asked solicitously.
I'm a bit tight.
Pilbeam, Lord Tilbury's voice shook. Did I really understand you to say that you were speaking from Blandings Castle?
Quite.
A man capable of building up the Mammoth Publishing Company is not a man who wastes time in unnecessary questions. Others might have asked Pilbeam how he had got there, but not Lord Tilbury. He could do all that later.
Pilbeam, he said, this is providential. Kindly come to me here as soon as possible. There's something I wish you to do for me, most urgent.
A commission?
Yes, a commission.
And what,
inquired the voice playfully, yet with a certain metallic note,
is there in it for me?
Lord Tilbury thought rapidly.
£100.
A hideous noise sent his head jerking back. It was apparently a derisive laugh. When it was repeated more softly a moment later, he recognized it as such.
200, Pilbeam.
Listen, Tilbury. I know what it is you want me to do. Oh, yes, I know. It's something to do with a certain book.
Yes, yes.
Then let me tell you, Tilbury, that I've been offered 500 in another quarter and can easily work it up to a level 1,000. But seeing it's you, I won't sting you for more than that. Think on your feet, Tilbury. 1,000 is the figure.
Lord Tilbury thought on his feet. There were few people in England whom the prospect of parting with £1,000 afflicted with a greater sensation of nausea, but he could speculate in order to accumulate. And in the present case, what was a mere 1,000? A sprat to catch a whale.
Very well.
It's a deal?
Yes, I agree.
Right,
said the voice with renewed cheeriness.
Be in after dinner tonight. I'll bring the thing down with me.
What?
I say I'll bring you-know-what to you after dinner tonight. And now, arriva. Whatever it is. Tilbury, old cock. Au revoir, Tilbury. I'm feeling rather funny and I think I'll get a bit of sleep. I think I'll go home, Tilbury. Pip, pip.
There was a click at the other end of the wire. Pilbeam had hung up. Fingers tried the handle of Pilbeam's bedroom door. A fist banged on the panel. The detective looked up frowningly from the bed on which he lay. He had been on the point of sinking into a troubled doze.
Who's that?
Open this door and I'll show you who it is.
Is that old Galley?
Damn your impudence.
What do you want?
A little talk with you, young man.
Go away, old Galley, said Pilbeam. Don't want any little talks. Trying to get some sleep, old Galley. Tell him I shan't be down to dinner. Feeling funny.
You'll feel even funnier if I can get in.
Ah,
but you can't get in, Pilbeam pointed out.
And, laughing softly to himself at the wit and cleverness of the retort, he sank back on the pillows and closed his eyes again. The handle rattled once more. The door creaked as a weight was pressed against it. Then there was silence, broken shortly by a rhythmic snoring. Percy Pilbeam slept.